Have you been hitting the books and listening to lectures all day? It's time to relax, to unwind, and listen up. This is Brooke from Campus Chronicles, your go-to podcast for everything student life. No matter where you are in your academic journey, we have you covered. Think of us as a trusted mentor, friend, and confidant who always has your back. We'll be sharing inspiring stories, thought-provoking insights, and practical advice to help you succeed in and out of the classroom. So get ready to be inspired, enlightened, and entertained. Hello, hello, everyone. I am so excited to introduce you to this wonderful person. His name is Nathan McGurl, and he is the founder of The Study Buddy. Nathan, thank you for being here.
I'm thrilled. It's a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and he was recommended by the wonderful Dominique Thompson. So I know that we are going to have the most beautiful conversation. But before we dive into the juicy details, give me your origin story, the Cliff Notes version of who Nathan is and how you got started doing what you're doing.
Oh, sure. So I'm advancing in years. So my origin story feels like it may have been in sort of black and white, a little bit sepia. So if we cue those wavy lines, I suppose I was sort of a fairly typical kind of chap, British, obviously, very quintessentially so. At school, I was fine. Didn't really have to try very hard to get good grades to start with. And that sort of followed me through, I think. I had sort of dreams and aspirations, as we all do, but wasn't really the kind of person to put in an awful lot of work if I didn't have to. And that origin nub sort of saw me right the way through all of my life broadly to this point, Brooke, I would say. So good collection of GCSEs, did all right in A-levels. University came as a bit of a shock. So I did law and didn't really know how to work. All of that seems like it might be a bit far away. I then fell into marketing and digital at a time when we used to call it new media, actually, before the internet was piped into every home and every set of headphones. And so this brave new world of doing stuff in different ways. And all of that then led into working with digital technologies. I built websites, apps, proper nerdy stuff, tapped into all of that. But through the types of companies that I worked with, big blue chips, I would be managing sort of multi-million pound digital transformations. And for someone who is, in essence, that lazy, who didn't really know how to ever do any work, that's sort of a bit of a shock. And so you have to find a way in which you can manage stuff, either to look like you're doing a good job, although that's never a lasting success. People will find you out. Or actually how you manage loads of stuff that you need to do in order to meet a result. So that's sort of me, my origin, if you like. And I think that we get lulled into a false sense of security because as students, we can remember stuff, quadratic equations, bizarre quotes from American authors, all of this kind of thing that we think, oh, well, maybe I don't need to work too hard. The problem, of course, is that we do, because the why stuff is sticking in our brain can feel a little bit random, but there is actually, and quite literally, a science to it. And so we need to be more deliberate, I guess, about the way in which we learn, especially when we're at university. And so much of that is then being taken on ourselves. You haven't got a parent or a tutor over your shoulder telling you exactly what bits you need to revise and which bits you don't.
So where did the inspiration for the Study Buddy start?
So that was really easy. So my son was doing his GCSE exams, what would now be about 8 years ago, I reckon. And bless him, he's a chip off the old block. So cocky and lazy. He's going to do brilliantly. They're all going to be nines and A stars and what have you. And I don't need to do any work. I can carry on playing on the PS, whatever it is that he's playing on. And I'm not a pushy parent. I know that every pushy parent says that, but I'm genuinely not. What I didn't want for him to do is to look back and regret the fact that he couldn't be a quantum physicist or a brain surgeon or whatever it was he wanted to do simply because he hadn't sort of pulled his finger out and done any kind of work at all. And so actually we clashed a lot. And I'm quite a fun-loving guy.
I can see that completely. I'm not at all surprised.
No, my children would be very surprised to hear me say that, and for someone else to agree, to be fair. But it wasn't like that. We really clashed. And I couldn't really figure out why. But every time I saw Jake, I'd be saying to him, are you doing work? What, shouldn't you be working? I am working. Well, you're not working. You're talking to me about whether or not you should be working. This is crazy. Where's all the time going? And so we had this backwards and forwards, and it became quite a stressful household. And in the end, I just thought, I just want to know for him, what has he got to do and when has he got to do it? And that was sort of the heart of every conversation or row that we had, was broadly those two things. And so I applied project management thinking, which seems like then my sort of random, odd autobiographical start to that conversation really came into its own, because I could empathize with the laziness and the apathy and the manana procrastination that tends to hit us all when it comes to revision, and apply corporate project management style thinking to solve the problem. So I found out what he needed to do. I wrote it all down. And then I could say, well, this is it. This is your to-do list. All you have to do is work your way methodically through this list before your deadline, preferably, and you'll be fine. Why don't we try that? So the system was really clear. It was really simple. And what was, I think, what was the most interesting bit of it, certainly for Jake when he was at that age, was that I stopped being the problem that I didn't realize that I was being. So as a parent, obviously through love and affection, want him to do well. I tried bribery, that didn't work. So my next port to call was shouting. But actually, with me not taking that particular stance, actually he took control. And that was what he needed. He needed to feel like he could, I guess. And that I wouldn't be as judgy as apparently my superpower lets me be. And so, yeah, it sort of spiraled from there. Other parents then looked around and went, I don't know what's happened in the McGirl house, but I want in. Whatever it is that stopped that level of tension, can I have it? Because my little angel's driving me up the wall. And so I sort of spun it out and said, well, here's how I did it. As I say, that was 8 years ago. Then 5 years ago, I created the Study Buddy as a way of putting together the tools and resources that families need, predominantly for GCSE, but A-level. We also do have some university students, which is amazing, using the system, as well as the younger learners as well. And sort of really helping those families and students to fulfill their potential by managing their own time.
One thing I think is a struggle for a lot of university students, and I can relate to a lot of what you said about your son, is that you don't have that parent looking over your shoulder, or that caretaker, or like you mentioned, a tutor, somebody that's really advocating for you to get the work done and get the work done well. And that leads the way for a lot of procrastination, a lot of struggle, a lot of second guessing, a lot of self-doubt. What do you think our society is getting wrong about studying, about learning, about intaking information that's causing all of these miscommunications and hangups?
I'm not sure how much of it is new to be a societal problem today. But I do, I look back at Jake and my daughter Emily. So I've got a daughter who's doing her A-levels in a couple of weeks' time. Well, she's quite nervous. I'm quite relaxed. It's nothing to do with me. They're not my A-levels. When I look at the two of them in particular, there are some sort of key pivotal moments that I look back on and I think, why? Why was that the case? And here in the UK, and I think a lot of students, certainly a lot of parents, if they happen to be listening, will be able to relate to the learning log. And in primary school, a lot of schools do this thing where you go home, you have a topic, a little project that the kids have to work on. So they might be 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. And they come home and you have to do these A3 pages of stuff. And so we'd let Emily do them. And so Emily at 6, bless her, trying hard, wax crayons all over the place, a sticker here, a word search there. Who knows what's going on? But she is living life and loving it. And the tutors have gone on to 2 A4 sheets of paper, and then it's gone. And she comes home and she's got 1 house point. But so-and-so's got 6 house points. How the hell did so-and-so get 6 house points? What do you get house points for at that age in any case? So what then happens is, as a parent, I go, well, I can't have you feeling like that. Let me help you. Well, helping starts to come like, oh, I'm not sure that those colours go together. And then all of a sudden it becomes me spending a weekend doing a 3D pop-up pirate ship. so that she can get 7 house. But why am I making 3D pop-up pirate ships at 40-something years old? I've done my time doing those kinds. But that's my role as a parent, to help her and to shield her from the, I don't know, embarrassment or the whatever it might be of having few housemates. And of course, if I'm doing that, another parent is doing it. And so we're all doing learning logs. It gets to the point then that our children have to learn and do the stuff for themselves. And as I say, for us, that was the GCSE age. Because I'm not sitting the exam for them. I can do the pirate ship, the word search, the crossword, but I can't sit physics GCSE with the best will in the world. And now we're at this point where, well, what do you mean I have to do it? What does that actually look like, me doing it? And so I think with all the best intentions of the world, what we've ended up doing as a generation of parents is overcompensating and taking that responsibility and accountability away from our children because we think it's the right thing to do. But it hasn't served them well when they then have to come and stand on their own 2 feet.
Do you think that self-trust, the ability to just really sink in, trust yourself, know that you can do it alone or in opposition or in struggle, how does self-trust play into your work and your research and what you've learned? And when parents are taking on, you know, that academic stressor for them, how does that impact self-trust down the line, like in university, for example?
So I think self-trust is a really interesting one because it's, I wonder whether we could look at it as being sort of an innate safety net. So actually, it's not so much about knowing that I'll do well as being assured that actually I'll be able to recover if things don't go well. Or hopefully, I guess, inevitably when things don't go wrong. When things don't go well. Because actually that's when we really learn. That's how you know. That's growth comes from that. I tried something, it didn't work out. I feel assured enough, confident enough, trusting myself enough, to use your words, to have another go or to try it somehow differently. All of these things, I think, are then sort of vital.
Absolutely. Well, I love the way that you put that about safety net if things go wrong, because it's easy to feel like maybe not getting the grade that you were hoping for on a test is the end of the world. I'm sure you experience a lot of that.
Yes, absolutely. And so, I mean, it's interesting for us because I don't know. The study buddy isn't oriented around getting grades. So none of our marketing or positioning is about getting the A stars or the night, very, very deliberately, because actually it's about fulfilling potential. And I think it's really, really important that for us, it's about learning good habits and doing those kinds of things, because actually there can be very destructive force behind believing that you have a benchmark that you need to hit. It's the amazing Einstein quote, if you judge a fish by his ability to climb a tree, you'll forever go around thinking that they're stupid. And I do think that our education system has an element of that benchmarking going on. So it shouldn't be about what's happening to get the nines and eights. It should be about what it is that you can do and knowing that you've done the best that you can. As I say that, I feel a little nauseous for just how saccharine, sweet and optimistic I know that sounds. Because actually the harsh reality is Oxford and Cambridge universities are going to take you based on getting so many points and A stars.
As I'm sitting here listening to you, one thing I think that our society does so wrong, and I'd love to get your input on this because I'm very curious, is this concept of I will be good enough once I do this thing, whether it's once I stop procrastinating less, once I get a better grade, once I establish a more productive routine. What's your opinion on the constant search of I will be good enough when, as it relates to students and studying?
I think good enough is really destructive. There's nothing but negative that comes from that, because you're benchmarking against something that's not smart. And I mean smart in the specific, measurable, achievable, realistic and timely, as opposed to clever. I will be better when, absolutely fine, because that talks to me of growth. It talks to me of sort of development, of testing boundaries, of trying something a bit more. But good enough for what? Good enough for who? And are they really worthy of having that lofty status attached to them that someone else should be dictating what it is that I should be trying to attain?
I love that because every student has a different struggle. I know for me, it was math. And, you know, a lot of people joke about math and will say, oh, I hate math. I just genuinely wasn't good at math because I'm a creative. And everybody has that different lane or space or place where they really excel. And also that place that's essentially a growth area. But attaching the status of I have to do everything perfectly, every course perfectly, everything perfectly, I think is really destructive. And in university, you're often pulled in a number of different directions.
Mm, absolutely. If I can, I'd like to just go back to what you just said about how you're not good at maths because you're a creative. And actually, and challenge that. And this isn't about being good enough or different styles of where your strengths actually lie. But I would say that I'm a creative person. I'm chaotically creative often.
I can see the chaotic creativity just going through your veins. I love it.
And my daughter told me this morning, this is my fisherman era. I don't actually even know what this means. But,
oh, your daughter's probably a Taylor Swift fan. I see that through the era.
Could be. Because actually what we tend to find is that we will pigeonhole ourselves. So I'm a creative person. I don't do maths. I don't understand how percentages work, and I couldn't work out probability, all of those kinds of things, because I'm arty, creative, or I'm much more sciencey. I don't get on with humanities. I hate writing essays, all of these. And so we tend early on to put ourselves into a niche. What of course that means is that we try harder at the thing that we think we're best at. So whether that's creatives or sport or maths, even maths. And so we'll focus our energies and our efforts on that thing that we think we're good at. Because we think we're good at it, we're going to enjoy it some more because we'll see success. If we see the success coming from that, we're going to try some more because, of course, I like that feeling of success. And because I'm trying some more, I'm going to find that I'm excelling a bit more than I was, and so on and so on and so forth. So actually what you're doing is you're creating almost a self-fulfilling prophecy around the fact that you are stronger in your creative than you are in your maths because you're doing so much more on the creative side than in the maths. And a lot of this is that growth mindset idea of you might not be able to factorize at the moment, but actually you could. So I can't do it yet. It tends to be the kind of language that you'd want to hear. And again, coming back to the parenting role, we do this a lot. And you can see, and it's so interesting when you look at sort of live case studies. So if I take my own children again, which is handy because I think it'd be really weird if I talked about other people's children. So my son was sort of gifted, we might say, in inverted commas. He didn't really have to try the sort of that photographic memory style thing. There were some other actually really interesting, but maybe for another podcast, societal issues around sort of gender nuance between the ways that we treated him as opposed to our daughter. But nevertheless, when Jake went to do a test, he would do well in his test. And we would say to him, that's amazing. You got 10 out of 10. 10 out of 10 is amazing. Well done. You're natural at maths. When Emily came to do tests, actually, she didn't have the same kind of interest, I guess, maybe not same kind of natural memory attachments that went with the information. And so she wouldn't get 10 out of 10s, but she'd have always tried really hard. And so actually we'd say to her, I'm really proud of you, Em, because you've tried so hard. Couldn't be prouder. It doesn't matter that you didn't get 10 out of 10. You tried. And that's what I really want. And actually, I genuinely mean that. That is, of course, what I really want. The interesting thing, of course, comes, it's primary school. It's broadly irrelevant whether you get all your spelling tests right or not. But when you then come later, actually what we found is that we capped Jake. So we put a ceiling on what he needed to do, because why would he try something new with the risk of failing when appreciation comes from the fact that he achieves 10 out of 10? He'll stick to the shallow water. He'll stay with the stuff that he knows is safe for him academically and praise-wise, because he doesn't have to try to get the praise. Emily, on the other hand, is fueled by effort. And that praise that she gets better. And so we then find that really interesting thing where actually Jake sort of maxed out. He did well and did do really well. But Emily's now doing better than him. Not that he'd want to hear that if he...
No, that would deeply offend him. Does that translate to emotionally and socially as well?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just about the academics. I mean, I could be wrong, because... And I think a lot of that comes from other stuff, the sort of the parenting roles, the fact that they're both poster boy and poster girl for well-being. And I want to take at least some of the credit from that. I guess my wife, their mum, is also involved. But I think that kind of safety net, to come back to, and actually something that we talked about a second ago, is really key. And I think it is that grounding of actually, it doesn't matter if they've tried something and it doesn't go well outside of the academics, there's support we're there for them. I don't mean financially or all of any of those guys. I just mean like belief. Like it's fine. We'll try again. Let's see if we can puzzle that through together.
Shifting gears, I'm curious. When you were in university, how did you approach studies? What did you think about them?
So there's a level of honesty that I feel that we should have. So as I say, I did law at university. I was predicted 3 A's at A level. Well, actually 5. I was really properly nerdy, so I did sociology in my spare time and some other. So I was expecting, the expectations were high. I was going to do well. I got to university and the level of freedom that I found was just phenomenal. And so actually I spent more time studying the bottom of a pint glass than I ever studied, taught or contract. I had an amazing time and came out with a 2-2. Whereas my tutors and everyone were saying I should have got first, I should have done all this. I mean, I am where I am. And I can't regret anything about my life to that point, because actually I've got an amazing life, amazing family, amazing experiences, all of those kinds of things. But in the moment, yeah, my approach to study, I started off really well. It was full of good intentions. I had, just to completely date stamp myself, I had an old Amstrad computer. And so I would come home religiously, type up my criminal law notes and my contract law notes and all of these kinds of things. And I think that lasted maybe about half a term until I found my tribe. I found my tribe. And then, as I say, there was a lot of partying and not a lot of working. And as I say, everything's worked out well. And I think that's also the key thing, because we tell our students that, and we tell our children that, and we tell each other that. These exams aren't the be-all and end-all, and they're not. And Dom would have talked about this idea that life is wiggly. And actually, the straight line between you and your destination, your goal, is a nonsense, absolute nonsense. It's not straight. You'll go all over the place to get to where you think you want to be. But actually, at the same time, I think the caveat that should come with that, and the bit that I don't think as a society we concentrate on enough, is, but why would you want to make your life unnecessarily hard for yourself by just not applying yourself a bit more? I didn't need all the lions that I had. I enjoyed them at the time, but I don't look back and remember them. But I do remember the 2-2 that I got in my, the third that I got in a constitutional law essay, because actually that was a bit embarrassing. I should have done better than that. And so I think that what we need to find is balance. And that's definitely the bit that I come away from my experience of university, is I didn't have that balance.
No, and that isn't advertised. And something that I find very interesting is, yeah, you might have made, you know, if you had your belief system now, you would have made different decisions. But I also think it's important to know that, yes, perhaps last term you made decisions that weren't ideal for you, whether that was not sleeping enough, whether that was not proper nutrition, whatever it is, it's okay to say, I made decisions that weren't right for me last term, and I'm going to make new ones moving forward. Sometimes I think we have such a hard time making that transition.
I agree completely. And actually, I'd probably maybe even go a step further and say, actually, it's essential that you do that, that you accept that actually what I did last week, what I did last term wasn't right. And taking time to deliberately sort of give yourself that feedback loop of saying, well, what went well? Let's do more of that. What didn't go so well? Can I fix that? Can I avoid that? And I think, and certainly from a planning point of view, that's what we advocate. And it's the kind of thing that we can do easily at university or at any point in our life, whether it's moving home later on in life beyond university, or right now, is to look at a period of time. So a sprint, as we might call it in project management terms. So for the next fortnight, I'm going to think about this piece of work. I'm going to plan my time. I'm going to factor in my lie-ins if they're important to you. I'm going to factor in my nights out because they ought to be important to you. And amongst that, I'm going to put in my study time. And then you get to the end of your sprint, whether it's a week or a fortnight or a term, as you say, and look back, sort of that retrospective, what went well, what didn't go well, what am I going to do again? What am I going to change? And then that feedback loop that you get yourself into, I think is absolutely a paramount importance.
Okay, so I'm going to hit you with a really, really hard question. If you were to give three pieces of advice, or what are the three things you want people to know about studying? They can be in a number of different directions, but if you could say three things to our viewership.
Okay, you're right. That was hard. So I think three things. The first thing, now is the time to start, because you can't start yesterday. It's already been gone. So forget lamenting what it is that you haven't done. Start now. If that can be, the longer you've got, the better it is. The lazier you can become if you start sooner rather than later, because little and often absolutely beats cramming every day of the week. That comes with a massive caveat, but the forgetting curve will tell us that actually you need to study now. And so that would be my first one, would be to start now. My second one would be really, really clear about what it is that you have to learn, what it is that you need to study. Because if you approach this with your eyes closed, or even sort of semi-chaotically, just to say, I'm studying geography, I'm going to do glaciers. I mean, these things are huge, and they can be really overwhelming, and it can feel like you're going to flounder from the very, very beginning. It pays dividends to absolutely think very clearly, break it down into bite-sized chunks, and say, my course is made up of these modules. My modules are made up of these tutor sessions, and work to that level of detail so that you know what it is that you've got to do. And the benefit of that is that you're in control. There's nothing coming out of the sidelines that you weren't expecting, because you've taken the time to be very deliberate, to be very clear about what it is that you need to study. And also that you can use that to plan against. You can cover your whole course, confidence builds, all of those kinds of things. There is an amazing thing to do. And then the third thing, if I haven't actually snuck in at least five or six, I think in the two rants that I had. So then I think my third thing is to be clear about when. Now that sounds really obvious, because I'm a planning man, but it's not in the sense of being boring, because actually in my personal life, I'm not a planner. I'm absolutely about living in the moment. So I'm actually 25 years married this May, and it comes from being a complete, happily spineless person. just do what I'm told. So I'm really go with the flow, really relax, absolutely. But when you've got something to do, actually you can structure your time, and it's not about being militaristic. This isn't about saying, right, I'm definitely going to do this here, come on me. You need to accept that plans will change, that things are going to be a bit different, that you're not going to get your planning right the first time. But if you know what it is that you've got to do, you can make a view on when it is that you're going to do it. Follow the plan. There's time in the day. It's only when you look back and you think, oh my word, where is that? Where's all that time gone? You would have known where the time had gone if you sort of set it up. And that's that weird relationship that I think that we have with how long something's going to last. If I put something off till later, so I've got 10 hours in the day, you've got an hour's worth of work. That's fine. It's loads of time. I'll do it later. You get to midday, you've had your lunch, which hopefully is nutritious and balanced. But you've had your lunch and you're thinking, right, well, I've got 5 hours left. Well, that's fine. 20% of my time. There's loads of time. I'll do it later. And then you get to sort of 10 o'clock at night. And you think, oh God, I've got to go to bed at 11. The rest of my day is going to be spent doing this hour's worth of work. Well, it's still only 10% of your whole day. It's just you chose to leave it to the very end and monopolize that end bit. And if at that point you realize that hasn't worked for you, then you know that tomorrow you need to do it an hour before. And it's that feedback loop that we talked about earlier that I think really comes into play. So yeah, knowing what you need to do, but absolutely being clear about how you think it's going to work will not just help you to be in a position where you can sit confidently in your exams, but alleviate so much of that untold, unknown stress that we carry around with us, that anxiety that comes from, have I done enough? Am I prepared enough? Should I have done more? If you can be in that sort of exalted position where actually I know I've done it, I know I've done all I can, actually that's a huge burden off of your soul, I guess.
Oh my goodness! If you could say a 1-2 sentence piece of advice that would be sort of the, I don't know, golden nugget that people would hold on to after they listen to this, what would that 1-2 sentence piece of advice be? Sort of like a quote, if you will, a Nathan quote.
Oh, Nathan quote. I'm hoping it's not about studying pint glasses, because I think that could come back and bite me.
Yeah, we're going to make it not about that.
I think the golden nugget is it is achievable. You can achieve what it is that you set out to do, but you need to, more often than not, be quite deliberate and focused about the steps that you need to take. But that doesn't have to come at the expense of having fun, and it doesn't have to come at the expense of having a life. But very, very few people achieve their potential by mistake.
That's beautiful.
Actually, that sounded so much better than I expected it to be.
And that I love that you added about the fun, because the fun is so crucial. Nathan, I've had fun with you. I do feel smarter walking out of the conversation than I felt walking in. So we're going to take that. If our viewership has listened to this and they love the things that you're saying, they want to learn more about your programs and about you, where can they find you?
So the studybuddy.com is always the first port of call. We've got a blog which talks about some of the things that we've actually touched on today and many others, why neurodiversity is a myth, all of these kinds of things. We also have our own podcast, which you can find on the website, which talks about lots of different things, typically around studying and supporting students as well. So the Study Sessions podcast can be found there as well.
So if you want to go soak in more of this amazing person's wisdom, you can go to thestudybuddy.com and you're going to have so much from him just right there.
Even better than that, you'll hear from the expert guests that I spoke to who gave me the platform to pretend that I know what it is that I'm talking about when I talk to other great podcast interviewers such as yourself.
You're going to learn so much if you just hop on over to the Study Buddy like I learned with him today. Nathan, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Brooke, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for joining me on Campus Chronicles. I hope you found our discussion informative, inspiring, entertaining, and fun. We are always working hard to make sure that our episodes are the very best they can be, which means we need your help. If you liked what you heard, remember to hit the follow button on your favorite podcast platform and drop us a review. It helps us to connect with more students who are hungry for success. And remember, the journey never stops. Keep listening, keep learning, keep growing. See you next week for another amazing episode of Campus Chronicles.